A Ride Through the Air is just one of the many fantastic adventures undertaken by Don Quixote and his squire, Sancho Panza. At least one of them thinks that they're riding through the air. The Ingenious Gentleman Don Quixote of La Mancha by Miguel de Cervantes, in that wonderful book, so influential, as we'll find out soon. It raises, among other questions, though, what is real and what's imaginary in this book that's called The First Modern Novel. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. Guiding us through the adventures or misadventures of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza is Stephen Hutchinson, professor of Spanish and Portuguese at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and welcome to University of the Air.
Hi, thank you very much.
Let's see, did I read somewhere that after the Bible, Don Quixote is what, the most translated book in the world?
It certainly is, yes. Not only the most translated, but also the most commented book. That is, if you go to any library, you're going to find that this book, besides the Bible itself, has more commentaries, more books written about it, and every single epoch has a different version of Don Quixote.
And Cervantes lived a life that I suppose would, by the sound of it, give him plenty of experience to draw from in writing about all these, as I say, adventures and misadventures of Don Quixote.
Absolutely, yes. He actually wrote this when he was quite advanced in years. He published the first part. It comes in two parts, and they're both about equal in size, even though there are more chapters and shorter ones in the second part. So if you think of it as a more or less a 1,000-page novel, you have 500 each, more or less. And he published the first part in 1605 and the second part in 1615. So there's a 10-year gap between that, and he died the next year on the same date, not exactly the same day because of difference of calendars, but the same date as Shakespeare. And that's why in many countries, the 23rd of April, 1616, and every year since then, I mean, is every year there are book fairs, and it's called the Day of the Book.
Celebrating Cervantes and Shakespeare. A colorful time and place, Spain, in the second half of the 16th century. How was Cervantes caught up in it?
Yes. First of all, I should say that he was from a fairly poor family. His father was a surgeon, which is not what we consider to be a surgeon nowadays. It's sort of a combination of barber and surgeon, somebody who knows how to cut. And it was often a profession that was associated with Jews. There's never been any definitive proof of Cervantes' possible Jewish ancestry, but it's certainly there. It's in the air, and it hasn't been disproved either. So it's one of those options that's open. You know that in 1492, of course, that's a key date, and not only for the voyage of Columbus, but also because it was the date of the conquest of Granada. The kingdom of Granada was the last Moorish, that is, Islamic empire in Western Europe. And it was also, a couple of months later, the date of the expulsion of Jews who refused to convert to Christianity. So about half of the Jews of Spain left. There was a time, centuries earlier, when half of the Jews in the world are calculated to have lived in what we now call Spain, mostly Andalusia in the southern part, in the Islamic part. But in any case, so Cervantes was brought up in a fairly itinerant family. They moved from city to city. His family was fairly poor. He was one of six children in that family. There were a lot of problems later on in that family, especially with the daughters and having problems of love with nobles who promised them marriage and then withdrew. And so he was caught up in some of that. But it was at the age of 21 or 22 when he had to flee Spain because he was apparently and I say apparently most of the evidence points to this, caught up in a sword fight with somebody more noble than he was, probably because of one of his sisters. And he had to flee Spain and go to Italy. And next time we find him, he was serving in the court of a very young cardinal. In those days, they had young cardinals. And so he was there for a number of months, and then he joined the military service. And at that time, there were two major empires in the Mediterranean world. They were the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans had taken Constantinople, which then became Istanbul, in 1453. That's one of the major dates of universal history. And on the other hand, there was the Spanish Empire, which was mostly directed outside of the Mediterranean, but also inside. And so he was part of the inside part of this the activities of the Spanish Empire, and they were allied with Italy and with the Pope and such, and he fought in one of the major battles during that time, 1571, the Battle of Lepanto. He was injured in that battle and got a couple of shots, actually firearms, you know, he got bullets in his...
Bullet wounds.
Yeah, in his chest, and one in his left wrist, which disabled his left hand for the rest of his life.
And it was a time, as you say, when Muslims, although they had been expelled from Spain, were controlling much of the Mediterranean world.
That's right, yeah. So the Muslims themselves, throughout the 16th century, they were required to become at least nominal Christians, and some of them were actually Christians. It's very hard to know who of them were and who were Christian, who were crypto-Muslims. But this becomes a major theme in Don Quixote itself, and particularly the expulsion of the Moriscos takes place while Cervantes is writing the second part of Don Quixote. So it's he published that the second part in 1615, and the expulsion was all of the years preceding that, at 1609 to 1614. So it's a major theme in the second part of the novel. I should also mention, I'm sure I'll come back to it, that this book is supposedly, and I say supposedly, within the fiction of the book, is written by a Muslim author named Sidi Hamete Benengeli, or Benengeli. A lot of interpretation has gone into these names. Sidi is like El Cid, is the master, the Lord. Hamete is probably Hamid, the Arabic name. And Benengeli, it could be the son of the evangel or something to that extent, but it's not. But it's often interpreted as being a Muslim, as a son of the Quran itself. So it was a very adventurous move on Cervantes' part to attribute this book to a Muslim author.
And when the Muslims had been expelled from Spain and were not exactly persona grata, I suppose you would say.
And it was written originally in Arabic, according to this version of it.
Right.
Which was a prohibited language.
That is an interesting take. What experience did Cervantes actually have with Muslims?
Mm-hmm. Within his, let's say, earlier life, we really have no idea. I mean, he did travel quite a bit in Andalusia, and his parents took him there. And his upbringing was in those kinds of places where there were lots of what we call Moriscos, which are Moorish people who could have been Christians or Muslims. We just don't know, but they were all nominal Christians, and so he would have known quite a few of them. But it was actually after he left Spain that he would have come much more in contact with Muslims. In the first instance, in major military campaigns against the Ottoman Empire, and so they were. I say there was the Battle of Lepanto, but there were various other battles. They conquered Tunis, and then the next year the city was conquered back by the Ottomans and so forth. There were various major military campaigns, and he was part of those. He served in all of those until 1575, when he decided to go home and try to see what he can do to collect on what he had done so far, and he was captured at that point by corsairs. Corsairs are what I call state-sponsored pirates.
Uh-huh. Yes.
We don't really use the term pirate because there were very few pirates that were just working on their own. They all had patents, and they had to come back to their own countries, their cities, and so forth. And
privateers, we had.
Yeah, that's the English word. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he's captured by these corsairs, these privateers.
Mm-hmm.
Then what?
And he's taken to Algiers, which was the corsair or privateer capital of the entire Mediterranean, in a Mediterranean that practiced on both sides of the Christian-Muslim divide a great deal of what we call corsairing, or essentially pirate activities, but in the service of a state. So he was there for 5 years. And he tried to escape 4 times. He could have been killed for any one of those attempts at escape, but somehow he was saved. Not a hair on his body was touched. And so there's a lot of question about how this could have happened and who were the intermediaries of this. But somehow he was apparently part of a spy network that involved also Ottomans, and they were trying to work out a peace settlement between the two empires, the Ottoman and the Spanish, and they actually did that. And so he apparently was a minor part of this major attempt to calm down the Mediterranean so that the two empires could focus on other places and do harm elsewhere, but not confront each other.
So he gets back to Spain after 5 years of captivity by
yes.
these Muslim or Morisco privateers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Let's see, so 1480 or so?
That's right, 1580, yeah.
I mean, 1580, right.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's still a relatively young man at this point, despite all these experiences.
33.
Has to make a living somehow.
Yes.
What does Cervantes do?
Yeah. I should just go back a moment to talk about the importance of those 5 years, if you don't mind, and then we'll get to that. The 5 years in captivity were so important, and almost every scholar and reader of Don Quixote sees that as the critical moment in his own development. And it's a time when he sees a society that's entirely different from his own society. And he was among those captives who were allowed to walk around all day long, but they had to be had a curfew time at sundown and had to be back in their place for the night. And so he had he could walk around Algiers, which was it was probably the most diverse city of the entire Mediterranean. And it had Jews. It had a lot of Christian captives, obviously 25,000, which was an enormous number for that time. Many of them were put to hard labor, but he wasn't, because he was supposedly an important captive because he had important letters of recommendation, even though his family was really poor. So that's why it took so long for him to get out of there too, because his mother went begging around Spain trying to get some money to ransom him. But in the meantime, he was able to observe a society that was, in so many respects, culturally, ethnically, sexual practices and every other thing that you can imagine, languages.
Religion.
Religions.
At least.
Yeah, absolutely. Was so diverse that it enabled him to see his own society from the other shore.
Oh, to get perspective on his own
absolutely.
Society.
So he was able to see it from the outside. And his entire work after that, his entire literary career is actually after that. And has this perspective that practically no other Spanish author of the time has. And in fact, almost no European author has it at the time of seeing his own society in such a strange way, that is, from an entirely foreign perspective, having adopted, you know, seeing it from the way that he had lived Algiers for those 5 years.
When does he start writing about it? If he gets back to Spain in 1480 or so,
yes.
And Don Quixote doesn't come along,
yeah.
1580 or so, he gets back to Spain in 1605 before part one of Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. What's happening in those 25 years?
Right. Well, he wrote a number of plays and had them performed. Some of these plays, just a few of them, were rewritten and published in 1615, which is 35 years later. Well, and several of those plays, in fact, half of his plays, have to do with the Mediterranean world, and they're set in places in the Ottoman Empire. Two of them in Algiers itself, right? One in Jerusalem and other places. One in Istanbul. So. Every one of his collections of works, including Don Quixote itself, not as a collection but as a work itself, it has a wonderful story. It's called The Captive's Tale, and it takes about 40, 50 pages of Don Quixote, where a captive has had experiences very similar to Cervantes' own experiences, except that there's a love story attached to it.
We're by now well into the time of printing presses, so
yes.
These writings of his, by the time we get to Don Quixote, certainly are printed, and he's aware of that whole kind of print market, is he?
Absolutely. So by the time he starts writing Don Quixote, well, let's say around 1600 or so, there's no precise date. The printing press had been around for, let's say, at least 130 years or so. And there were certain kinds of genres that were printed all the time, religious works, prose works. Poetry, for odd reasons, was not published hardly at all. It was copied by people in their own notebooks and sort of circulated that way. Plays were very rarely printed, but in any case, that was kind of the market of it. A lot of religious writers, even humanists, even important humanists, were against the printing press because they felt that there was no way to control how people were going to read texts, and that, you know, they could end up in the hands of, you know, Lutherans or Calvinists.
Heaven forbid.
And even when works of fiction were officially banned, although a lot of them got through. They were officially banned in the New World. They weren't allowed to be distributed there. So people took them, you know, in their own baggage. But otherwise, there was no official way to distribute works because there was no way to tell, you know, whether the Amerindians, as they're called in Spanish, would be able to distinguish between the truth of the Bible and the fiction of something like Don Quixote.
Is it true that something like 400 copies of the first edition of Don Quixote went down with a ship off of
Absolutely,
Havana?
Yes.
So
they've never been recovered.
I suppose not. Gold, but not literature. Yeah. And so those first edition must be extremely rare then.
It is, yeah. And so we can find them in certain, you know, quite a number of libraries around the world, even in the United States. Obviously, the United States has collected a lot of these rare books, and so. But in the major, you know, the British Library, main libraries in Europe have copies of the first edition.
Did it make late in life? Did it make Cervantes his fortune?
He couldn't live off his work. And it was much more than Don Quixote. He was writing many other things, such as a wonderful collection of 12 short novels. In fact, what we call short novels now, you know, anything between, let's say, 20 and 60 pages, was then the word for novel in Europe. And Don Quixote was not called a novel. It was called a history. and history in Romance languages, histoire, historia, is the same word for story and history. So it bridges both fiction and supposed nonfiction.
Oh, that's an interesting. Yes, so something like a novel or a romance could mm-hmm. overlap with history, which is mm-hmm. by implication nonfiction.
Absolutely, and this entire novel, what we call novel of Don Quixote, plays all the way through with the idea that it's a history. And it's a true history, and that the author is unfortunately, you know, constrained by all the things he has to tell the truth.
Well, we're going to open the book right after this. We're talking about Don Quixote, and this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Stephen Hutchinson, and we're talking about Don Quixote, often considered the first modern novel and the second most translated book after the Bible, very, very influential after 400 years, and written at the same time that Shakespeare was writing his plays, just, you know, not that far away. Cervantes and Shakespeare, almost direct contemporaries. Well, you've mentioned, Steve, that it's a 1,000-page novel.
Yeah.
That covers a lot of territory, but give us some idea of the shape of it. And it is purportedly nonfiction, although,
yes,
of course, we call it a novel. What? Let's get first into the personality of the narrator.
Yeah. That's what one of the aspects that makes this such an innovative work. That is that there isn't really a narrator. There are many narrators, and there are authors within it. And so there's a wonderful moment, let's say, about, you know, before 10% of the way into the book, before 100 pages or so, where Don Quixote is fighting this kind of mock battle. I mean, for him it's not a mock battle, but for us it is, you know, where he's fighting a squire and they have swords, and the squire is defending himself with a cushion. And they both have their swords raised, and either one of them could split the other one absolutely down the middle with the sword. But the narrator at that point, who has been looking at local archives and finding information about Don Quixote in the local archives of towns in La Mancha, says that, you know, in this particular source that he found, it just gets to this point and he can't find any more information.
About what happens with this fight.
That's right. So it leaves us in high suspense.
We never get the end of it. We do later.
We do, right away, because, and that's one of the great moments early on in the book, because so this narrator who has been looking, who's supposedly a kind of historian, local historian, who finds other works by local historians, says, I can't find anything else. And so he tells the story in the next chapter of how he was looking in the city of Toledo. Now, Toledo is a really important city in the history of Spain, not only because it was for many centuries the capital of Spain, but also because for centuries it was the capital or the center of translation of practically all works that came from far away and in eastern countries. When I say east, you know, beyond Iran, you know, out of, even beyond that. And the 1001 Nights and all those kinds of works were brought in, and throughout the Arab world and such were brought in, and they were brought to Toledo to be translated. And so it's a convenient place for this to happen. And what happens is that this narrator is looking around, and he goes into a silk merchant's shop, and he sees this sort of pile of or somebody brings in a pile of big notebooks. So he asks, what's this? And he's very curious about things. He always looks at, you know what people read, write and so forth. And he opens one up and he finds that it's written in Arabic. And he doesn't understand Arabic. So he asks, and what's the price of this and what it is? And so he asks if somebody knows how to translate Arabic. And sure enough, even though it's a completely prohibited language as of 1567, so we're talking about 33 years earlier, or even more than that, anybody who was caught with anything in Arabic could be, jailed and subjected to the Inquisition. But he treats it as though, this is quite a normal thing. And so they bring in somebody, a young guy, who can translate between Arabic and Spanish, and he opens it up and he starts laughing. And he said, what are you laughing at? And he says, well, Don Quixote is doing this and the other thing. I said, really, Don Quixote? So it turns out that this pile of manuscripts is the rest of Don Quixote.
But it's a wry, tongue-in-cheek joke on Cervantes' part to
Absolutely.
Say, have one of the characters laughing at his book.
Absolutely. And that's what he wants people to do, to be laughing at it, because humor is such such an important ingredient of this book. So he gets this guy to translate the rest of the novel. And that's how we get the rest of the first part. And then it turns out to be written by a Muslim, according to this. So Don Quixote is not only the story, the fiction of characters such as Don Quixote and Sancho Panza and many others, but it's also a fiction about its own making.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't make much of it in the first half of the book, but in the second half of the book, he makes enormous amount. Where the Muslim author, is like one more character who's always present from beginning to end of the second part. This occurs, as I said, right in the middle of the expulsion of the Moriscos, crypto Muslims or whatever they were from different regions of Spain. So. This is one of the great moments in Don Quixote where we find out that everything is a translation according to this particular fiction of its own making.
So we're removed a couple of times over from the actual story of Don Quixote because we have these notebooks that have turned up from somewhere written
yes.
by a Muslim mm-hmm. author and then translated into Spanish about events that would have happened at what remove chronologically from the time the story is being written down?
It turns out that almost everything is almost contemporary.
Really?
And the kinds of books that are referred to and everything else, and even the other narrators all come to the conclusion that this is a really modern story.
Uh-huh.
It just happened, the day before yesterday.
Uh-huh.
I should also mention that why are these books, these big notebooks, taken into a silk merchant's shop? I mean, what are they doing there?
Right.
Yeah. Obviously, the silk merchant would have been Morisco himself. And he would have wanted them. There happened to be a crisis of the silk industry at that time, and the Moriscos were the ones who controlled that industry. They were the main producers of silk. They didn't have any mulberry leaves for the silkworms to eat. So what they needed to eat were the pages of these of this manuscript. So our narrator saves the entire rest of Don Quixote, that's 90% of it,
from the silkworms.
From the silkworms. They were all destined, as Hamlet and Horatio would say, as food for worms.
And that's another kind of device that the authors, Chaucer does a little bit of in Canterbury Tales where he has the poet starts to tell a story and it's so bad that everybody shuts him up,
right.
It's this kind of self-deprecating humor of the author.
Mm-hmm. There's a great deal of that all through Don Quixote.
What about Don Quixote himself? Now, on the one hand, from a contemporary sensibility, it's like the man is deluded. It's a tragedy,
yes.
You know, and then he realizes only at the end of book two, you know, his mistake, and it's a tragic ending. But in the meantime, you have lots of comedy. So what's with Don Quixote? What is his real perspective on this whole thing?
Yes. The way that Don Quixote has been read has often had to do with the romantic sensibility, and the romantics tended to identify much more with Don Quixote himself and his impossible dream, if you will.
Heard that term somewhere.
As opposed to Cervantes, and they seemed to think that, they often said that Cervantes was very cruel with his main character.
He gets beat up all the time.
He does, yeah. It's often in a kind of slapstick way and in like comic characters who get beat up and then they just, you know, pop right up, especially in the beginning of the novel. In fact, the novel itself, the first six chapters out of, you know, more than 100, that 127, I think, is the total number that we have ultimately. First six chapters seem to have been a project in itself that Cervantes wrote and with no intention at the beginning of making it into a bigger novel. And so it's very slapstick, and Don Quixote doesn't have much depth. It's funny, and it's we have, but he seemed to realize in those first five or six chapters that there's more here than that he could really develop, and so we have characters who develop all the way through, and of course it's at that point after seven chapters or so that Sancho Panza comes into the story as well, and so they're companions for the rest of the entire novel,
and of course, great foils, great contrasts, yeah. Physically and psychologically from each other. The premise is it that Don Quixote has been reading too much of this romantic chivalric literature and then can't distinguish fiction from reality.
Can't or doesn't want to.
But he's continuously on this quest, and again, from a kind of contemporary sensibility,
yeah.
If he sees a prostitute and turns her in his mind into a princess,
that's right.
And does this with characters consistently, these low-life characters,
yes.
You could say that this is him seeing the nobility in even ignoble people.
That's right, yeah. He does that for sure, especially throughout the first part. And in the first part, Sancho Panza takes the role. He seems to be a very simpleton, peasant at first, but very quickly we find out that he's much more than that. And he becomes an apprentice. And by chapter 20 or so, which isn't, you know, that far into it, he already is mastering the ways that Don Quixote thinks, the way that Don Quixote speaks, and he's really gotten a hold of what he's supposed to do as a squire. So the two work together really interestingly, as of that point. So Don Quixote throughout the first part does follow through with that particular script. In the second part, the novel opens up a great deal more. The idea is that Sancho already knows what he's supposed to do, so he doesn't have to be taught how to be a squire for a knight errant. And they can talk not only about novels of chivalry and heroes of chivalry and that kind of thing, but about anything in history, anything about the world. So the entire novel opens up in conversation. And a lot of the novel is actually dialogue between the two characters as they're moving along.
I mean, and ever since, squires have been wonderful, not only foils, but also conversationalists for the main character to express his thoughts. Is there overarching, though, is there any kind of a quest that unites all of these chapters, these various comings and goings of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza?
Right from the beginning, there's this sense that Don Quixote has to do good in the world, and that continues to be important all the way through. He messes up a lot right at the beginning. He doesn't figure situations out, and he A lot of the people he tries to help actually ends up harming. But in any event, he continues with this idealistic quest all the way through, actually. Sancho Panza has figured out a lot of things in the meantime and becomes really more of a protagonist than Don Quixote himself, because Don Quixote is much more predictable than Sancho Panza, especially in the second part. We know more or less what Don Quixote is going to do. Obviously, he has some marvelous speeches, and we don't know how he's going to generate these speeches. They're really great, but Sancho is the one who really takes over. Partly because other characters. One of the great things that happens in this novel is that. As I said, the novel was published in two parts, 10 years apart, and by that time, many people had read Don Quixote Part One, and also the characters that we encounter in Part Two have also read Part One.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting. Again, the characters reading the book that they're in,
right?
And so, how does Sancho Panza develop then?
Mm-hmm. Well, he has to develop because there's a moment in the first part where he's sent. Don Quixote is doing some sort of penitence. He kind of invents his own kind of penitence. There's no reason why he should engage in penitence.
Well, I was wondering, yeah.
Yeah, but he figures that he should do it in any case so that Sancho can go to El Toboso, where Dulcinea is, and explain to her how his master is suffering for her, even though there's no particular reason to do so.
Uh-huh.
So Sancho actually gets interrupted in the middle of his travels and doesn't get there. So he has to invent what happened in El Toboso. And so this lie of his, he has to build on it all the way through the second part of Don Quixote. And the characters who have read the first part of Don Quixote know that he has lied to his master. And so they invent a case where... the next point is that they go to El Toboso, and Sancho has no idea who Dulcinea is at that point, but he's supposed to find her in her palace, which of course she doesn't have because she's a humble lass, so he decides the only way to get out of this is to intercept three village women. Leaving that particular village and bringing Don Quixote over and saying, "This is Dulcinea."
One of the three is Dulcinea.
That's right.
And he's supposed to pick which one.
And he tells Don Quixote which one. And so Don Quixote thinks that he has cataracts in his eyes. And of course, Don Quixote has always been explaining the difference between appearance and reality as an effect of the enchanters. So he uses that explanation again, and that he's been cursed by these enchanters, so that he can't see the beauty and so forth of Dulcinea. It's a very, very funny scene because she falls, she jumps off her donkey, and then jumps back on it. But in any case, Sancho gets out of that particular thing, but other characters find out about that, and so they. In a duke and duchess's country house, they set up all kinds of theatrical performances where even Merlin comes along and says that the only way that you can disenchant, because she's been enchanted, obviously, that's what Don Quixote thinks, the only way that you can disenchant Dulcinea is to have... Sancho give himself 3,300 lashes on his behind.
And how does that play out?
Right. Well, that's one of the main themes of the whole thing, because Sancho doesn't like pain. Uh-huh. But it's all voluntary. And so Don Quixote depends on Sancho to disenchant her in that way. And finally, Sancho, one night, he goes a little ways away from where Don Quixote is, and he starts giving these lashes, but not to himself, but to the trees there, and moaning and groaning at Don Quixote. So he almost gets to the end of the 3,300, but somehow Don Quixote realizes that this is never going to happen. She's never going to be disenchanted at the end.
We'll look further at Don Quixote, the masterpiece of Cervantes, right after this. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Stephen Hutchinson, and we're looking at Don Quixote. Now, it's a 1,000-page novel, often considered the first modern novel, but there is no way, of course, that we can get very deeply into its many faceted aspects of characters and setting. But I did want to get back just briefly to this contemporary of Cervantes, which is William Shakespeare.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, as I think we mentioned, they died on the same date. There might have been one day difference as far as the dates were concerned. The calendars were different, about 10 days or so. So we won't go into the – nobody really cares about that discrepancy. But it both authors are considered the authors of their – respective languages. In fact, in Spanish, another word for English is the language of Shakespeare, and in Spanish, it's the language of Cervantes. You know, and so they are considered and have been actually ever since the German Romantics in the early 19th century. There was this idea that every nation had its own genius, and so Shakespeare was obviously the genius of the English, and so on, and Dante, and Shakespeare, and a few others. So it's a kind of founding genius is part of our own legacy from the Romantics. Now, there's no evidence that Cervantes had any knowledge of Shakespeare. Almost all of the information traveled in the other direction. England was a very up-and-coming nation. It was striving to become an imperial nation, but wasn't really one yet, except it had, you know, Virginia, but that was about all, you know. Cervantes, Spain had an enormous empire at the time. England was very interested in Spanish fiction of many different kinds, including the novels of chivalry that Don Quixote was reading. Shakespeare did know about Cervantes. There was a translation almost immediately, a few years after the first part. I don't think he ever got to know the second part, which actually is the greatest part, and that's what put him on the map forever. But the first part, and the first part includes a number of kind of novels or pseudo novels. That is, characters come in and tell their own stories, and they read kind of like a novel. And one of those novels has a character called Cardenio, and Shakespeare's known. His 38th play is known to be the history of Cardenio.
The 38th play that nobody has seen.
That is documented as he's having written probably with Fletcher.
Really?
And Stephen Greenblatt from Harvard, Shakespeare scholar, and worked together with a renowned playwright to make a very interesting modern play, but a play in which the original manuscript that Shakespeare, the last manuscript of Shakespeare, appears. They don't pretend to show the actual manuscript itself.
This starts to sound like Cervantes again, writing Don Quixote.
Absolutely. Shakespeare did write, probably in together with Fletcher, a work called The History of Cardenio, and it could only come from Don Quixote, Part 1. There are no other Cardenios in literature.
And we know, I know that we have by the early 18th century, we have, a composer like George Philip Telemann who wrote a suite, Don Quixote.
Yes.
And including the imitation of, some of the scenes with very clever musical effects. And so it was already an international sensation by the 17th and early 18th century.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And later on it will be Richard Strauss and various others.
Yes, that's what we started with. Well, quite a long tradition of that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of literature, what was the impact of Don Quixote?
Yes, enormous. First of all, it was fortunate not to become a classic for quite a while. That is the kind of classic that Mark Twain defines as one of those books that nobody reads.
Yeah, right.
So it was an immensely popular book. It was greeted with a lot of laughter in the 17th century, very different from, let's say, the Romantic period and onwards, where it was viewed as a very a bitter book and a very... Actually, I have a quote from Dostoevsky here, which I think is absolutely fabulous. And it goes beyond the Romantics. And I've always loved this quote. He admired Cervantes, in particular Don Quixote, a great deal. And he says, "There's nothing in the world more profound or powerful than this work. This is the ultimate and greatest word that human thought has yet produced."
You can't get much more laudatory than that.
"It is the bitter irony expressible by man. And if the world were to end and someone were to ask here or ask there somewhere, 'Well, did you understand your life on earth? What conclusions did you reach about it?' one could silently point to Don Quixote."
That's phenomenal. Yes, from Dostoevsky. You wouldn't have expected that. Dostoevsky, his writing is about as different from Cervantes as it could get.
Yes.
Not just because of the remove of centuries, but the whole spirit of the thing.
Absolutely, yeah. But he admired him immensely, and so did all of the writers, really. And I mentioned Mark Twain. Mark Twain actually doesn't write Huckleberry Finn in the ways that 19th century novels were written, with all in one place and such. It's a kind of more episodic road movie.
I mean, it is. That's right. Yes, without even exactly a definite end in terms of, mm-hmm. I mean, they're going down the river the wrong way for one
that's
thing.
Right.
and it mm-hmm. is analogous. You have the two characters,
mm-hmm. And right in the, I think it's this, one of the first chapters of Huckleberry Finn. You have before he's left and such, you have these kids playing out a scene of Don Quixote.
Oh, do they? I'd forgotten that.
So Mark Twain is somebody who loved Spanish picaresque and mm-hmm. Don Quixote. And there's a certain connection between the two, obviously. Not that Don Quixote is a picaresque novel, but that it
I wanted to ask you about picaresque. From Picaro, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the picaresque tradition. Oh, like Byron's Don Juan is a kind of a lampooning of the. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of the knight who just gets it wrong and is kind of the butt of the jokes as opposed to the perpetrator.
I view Don Juan and Don Giovanni as being, another great tradition, and it emerged in the same years as Don Quixote, in the sense that maybe 15 years later or so, the first plays about Don Juan were performed in the 1620s, and as of that point, it became internationalized right away. It got into Italy. It got into various other countries. And Mozart got a hold of it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, and Don Juan, Don Giovanni, mm-hmm. Don Juan, as Byron called him.
Yes.
It covers a whole spectrum. And Byron mm-hmm. was interested in making fun of, the lady killer.
Absolutely.
It was the one who was always seduced, not the seducer, that kind of thing. But you're saying that Don Quixote is not a picaresque novel.
It's really a chivalric novel, but it incorporates elements of picaresque, of pastoral, of various other all the genres that existed at that time. And in fact, it's one of those. It's a novel that incorporates everything else. It incorporates lyric poetry. It incorporates satiric poetry. Everything else. I think that both of these characters, I mean, no matter in what phase you see them as being, you know, satirized or not, because in the 19th century it certainly did satirize John Juan and a great deal. But they're characters who create their own kinds of adventures. And Don Quixote does that. Everywhere he goes is a pretext for creating an adventure. And so the same thing happens with Don Juan and Casanova, and they create their own kinds of adventures, and sort of the picaresque characters, they create their own kinds of adventures, which tend to be, you know, petty theft and stuff like that.
Yes. Well, getting back to this overall quest of Don Quixote to do good in the world.
Yes.
Sometimes, of course, in the picaresque tradition, I suppose the good you're doing is for yourself rather than anybody else.
And not very ethical.
Yes. In Don Quixote, as you've told us, Steve, a lot of times Don Quixote does more harm than good to the people he's trying to help out. But yes. But are there instances where he actually like goes over the top and succeeds in that quest?
Once in a while he does, yeah. But even towards the end there, he has pretty major failures. Sometimes he's led to believe that he succeeds when there's nothing of consequence going on in the second part.
So really, the story is about his own perception. His own view of the world and what's going on. It's not literally for the rest of the world what's going on, but it's a story about what's going on in the mind of Don Quixote.
Right, but it certainly has been an enormous inspiration for a great number of people. When I was even a teenager, I was, you know, meeting people who were into religious studies and things like that, who were all into Don Quixote, you know, because they felt that what they were doing was somehow parallel to what he was doing, and so they were really inspired by this novel, and that's been the case, and they realized that there was something that was, you know, a little over the top of what they were doing, but they really believed in their ideals and such.
We do have that word in English, quixotic.
Yes.
How does that relate?
Well, it's usually the more the part that has more to do with an illusion than with actually. Achieving any ideals, but the ideals are there for sure in Quixotic, and I think obviously enough, the one major icon that you have of this book is Don Quixote tilting at windmills.
Yes, that's the most famous scene, isn't it?
And it happens to be a pretty minor, you know, adventure in the book. It's very early on. He leaves home with Sancho, and the first adventure he has is with the windmills. That's all, and the first of many. And it's a very simple kind of thing where he says, look at those giants, and Sancho says, they're windmills. And Don Quixote says, no, they're not. It's a very simple thing, and things get much more complicated after that. But
it's a start. Well, we have just touched on the many and myriad adventures of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza as spelled out for us so graphically by Miguel de Cervantes all those 400 years ago. Thanks for sharing some of them with us, Stephen Hutchinson.
All right. Been a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.